Narayanam namaskritya naram cheva narottamam devim sarasvatim vyasam tato jayam udirayat. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 11, chapter entitled Lord Krishna's Entrance into Dwarka. Text number 12. Savatu Sava Vibhava.
Savatu Sava Vibhava.
Everyone say it at the same time. Punya Vriksha Latashramai.
Punya Vriksha Latashramai.
Ujjano Padna. Ujjano Pavana Ramar. Brita Padma Karashriyam. Savatu Sava Vibhava.
Savatu Sava Vibhava.
Punya Vriksha Latashramai.
Punya Vriksha Latashramai.
Ujjano Pavana Ramar. Ujjano pa, I'm sorry. Vrita Padma Karashriyam. Savatu Sava Vibhava. Punya Vriksha Latashramai. Ujjano Pavana Ramar. Vrita Padma Karashriyam. Sarva.
Sarva.
All. Ritu. Seasons. Sava. All. Vibhava. Opulences. Punya. Pious. Vriksha. Trees. Lata. Creepers. Ashramai. With hermitages. Ujjana. Orchards. Upavana. Flower gardens. Aramai. Pleasure gardens. And beautiful parks. Vritta, surrounded by. Padma Akara, the birthplaces of lotuses or nice reservoirs of water. Shriyam,
increasing the beauty.
Translation and purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. The city of Dwarkapuri was filled with the opulences of all seasons. There were hermitages, orchards, flower gardens, parks, and reservoirs of water, breeding lotus flowers all over. Translation responsibly. The city of Dwarkapuri.
The city of Dwarkapuri.
Was filled with the opulences of all seasons.
There were hermitages.
Orchards,
orchards,
flower gardens,
flower gardens,
parks and reservoirs of water,
reservoirs of water,
breeding lotus flowers all over. Purport. Perfection of human civilization is made possible by utilizing the gifts of nature in their own way. As we find herewith, in the description of its opulence, Dwarka was surrounded by flower gardens and fruit orchards, along with reservoirs of water and growing lotuses. There is no mention of mills and factories supported by slaughterhouses, which are the necessary paraphernalia of the modern metropolis. The propensity to utilize nature's own gifts is still there, even in the heart of modern civilized man. The leaders of modern civilization select their own residential quarters in a place where there are such naturally beautiful gardens and reservoirs of water. But they leave the common men to reside in congested areas without parks and gardens. Herein, of course, we find a different description of the city of Dwarka. It is understood that all the people dependent on nature's gifts of fruits and flowers without industrial enterprises. Yeah. Where was I up to? It is understood that the whole Dharma, or residential quarter, was surrounded by such gardens and parks with reservoirs of water where lotuses grew. It is understood that all people dependent on nature's gifts of fruits and flowers, without industrial enterprises promoting filthy huts and slums for residential quarters. Advancement of civilization is estimated not on the growth of mills and factories to deteriorate the finer instincts of the human being, but on developing the potent spiritual instincts of human beings and giving them a chance to go back to Godhead. Development of factories and mills is called ugra karma, or pungent activities, and such activities deteriorate the finer sentiments of the human being and society to form a dungeon of demons. We find herein the mention of pious trees which produce seasonal flowers and fruits. The impious trees are useless jungles only, and they can only be used to supply fuels. In the modern civilization, such impious trees are planted on the sides of roads. Human energy should be properly utilized in developing the finer senses for spiritual understanding, in which lies the solution of life. Fruits and flowers, beautiful gardens, parks and reservoirs of water, with ducks and swans playing in the midst of lotus flowers, and cows giving sufficient milk and butter, are essential for developing the finer tissues of the body. As against this, the dungeons of mines, factories and workshops develop demoniac propensities in the working class. The vested interests flourish at the cost of the working class, and consequently, there are severe clashes between them in so many ways. The description of Dwarka Dham is the ideal of human civilization. Omigyan timanandasya gyananjana shalakaya chakshur militamena tasmai shri gurave namaha. Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Tadati Swapadantikam Pancha Kalpata Rupyascha Kripa Sindhu Bhyevacha Petitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishna Vibhyo Namo Namaha. Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Srivasadi Gaura Bhaktivrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. So, Krishna is returning to Dwarka and has described what it is like in the eternal dham of Dwarka. As we said last week, that Krishna prefers Vrindavan over all other places, and it is described in the Nectar of Devotion that Dwarka is perfect, Mathura is more perfect, and Vrindavan is most perfect. So Krishna prefers, of all places, he prefers Vrindavan. He prefers the rural lifestyle. Srila Prabhupada says that Krishna is the cowherd acharya. He's teaching us how to live in human life, in human civilization. He's teaching us how to live. And then when he goes to Dwarka, he teaches us how to live in cities also. That cities should be in the mode of goodness, not the mode of passion or the mode of ignorance. We see that when Srila Prabhupada came to America and he saw Boston, when he arrived in America for the first time, aboard the Jaladutta, and he wrote in his diary, the Jaladutta diary, Srila Prabhupada said that all that he could see on the Boston skyline was the modes of ignorance and passion. So cities are there in the West, but they're just full of ignorance and passion. That is the vibration. If you go into Melbourne, or you go into Los Angeles, or you go into Mumbai, or you go into Hong Kong, or you go into Taiwan, or you go anywhere, Bangkok, it's just ignorance and passion. Lower modes of material nature. It is described in this material world, the most prominent mode of nature is... passion. Yeah, passion is the most prominent of all the modes in the material world. And passion, if it is not restrained, or if it is not harnessed, it turns into the mode of ignorance. If it is controlled, you can elevate it to the mode of goodness. But if it is not controlled, then it degenerates into the mode of ignorance. And we see that's what takes place all over the world. That passion just degenerates into ignorance. And the world is degenerating into ignorance. Basically, they're digging a pit which will be very difficult for all of them to get out of. The modern civilization, it is going down rapidly. You see, in the last 100 years, basically, I was watching a very good documentary. There's some excellent, excellent documentaries out there. Dave Marita Swami shows some of them on his retreats. Did he show that footprint one last time? Yeah. Can you get me a copy of that? Go. You've got a copy? Have you got a copy now? Yeah. Can you give me a copy of that one? Because I want to get a copy of that one as well. There's some excellent documentaries out there, which I've been watching lately. One of them is called Dirt. And it's a very good documentary because it shows that human society is completely dependent on the first 3 inches of oil, of topsoil or earth on this planet. That's what we're dependent on. And what we've done in the last 100 years is we are gradually ruining that top 3 inches. And because of that, it's becoming very difficult now for them to produce food of a high quality for human society. And Prabhupada points out in this purport, this is a famous purport actually, this particular purport, and many places in his books, that actual opulence of human society is to eat well. When you can eat good food. Just like these days, if you want to eat good food, you have to go to the South Melbourne market or to Passion Foods or to, you know, one of these shops, and you have to pay exorbitant prices for organic produce, which is rather ridiculous because 70 years ago, everything on earth was organic produce. There was nothing else but organic produce. Everyone on this earth just ate organic produce. Our grandparents grew up on organic produce. That's all there was. There wasn't an alternative. You don't have to go to the supermarket and pay extra to get organic. That's what everyone ate, organic produce. But then after World War II, military companies were producing masses of chemicals. And after World War II finished, there was a stockpile of chemicals, which they were using for the war. And then they thought, well, now what are we going to do? We have to sell these chemicals so we can make some profit. So they convinced the governments, you need to put these on your food. These chemicals which you're using in the wartime, they're also very good for food. Right? Put them on your food. Right? We need pesticides and we need fertilizers. So you need to start using these things. And it's very important for humans to have pesticides and and fertilizers, which are chemical-based. Very important. So they convinced the governments. The governments said, yeah, actually, you're correct. At the same time, monoculture or mono farming was developed. Up until that time, basically on Earth, if you look at India like these days, like Lokanath Swami or Bhakti Vaibhav Swami produced that nice video, The Lost Village, which is about Lokanath Swami's growing up in that particular place. What is it called? Aravade? Yeah, in that particular village. So it shows that in the villages, they grew all the food around the village, right? You grew grains, dal, fruits, vegetables, spices, oils, all around that village, right? So what happened in around about the time of World War II, early in this century, it was seen to be more profitable to have monocrops. So instead of just growing all your food locally around your village, we can just produce, you know, 15,000 hectares of corn or wheat, and then we can go out and we can harvest all that, and we can monopolize the market, we have it all, and then we can sell it overseas and start trading it all over the place, and we can make more money. So when that type of farming mentality, which is based on it's not based on necessity, or it's not based on just feeding ourselves, but it's based on economy, that changed the face of agriculture on the planet. And then at that time, then all the chemical companies, they came around and they said, okay, well, you've got these huge crops of wheat and corn, you need to spray them, otherwise the bugs will eat them. So they broke down the ecosystems, and then what took place is that now we have big problems. Now if you want to eat food, it's dangerous, basically. You're taking your life into your hands to some degree, basically. Because we see that these diseases like cancer and other diseases are rampant on the planet at the moment. And a lot of it's just to do with the food that we eat. Very interesting that, you know, now it's dangerous to eat food to some degree. And now people are paying more money to get organic food. But actually in the past everything was organic and all of us should just be eating organic all the time. Another interesting fact is that in the last 100 years we start making processed food. Previously, everyone would eat fresh. You'd go out and pick what was there fresh and then you would eat it. But then we thought, no, it's better instead of living on the land. Another interesting fact, I've been watching all these documentaries, so I've got all these interesting facts. One was that, say, 200 years ago when America was founded, 97% of the population of America were farmers. These days, 3% are farmers. Because now we think it's much more intelligent that we build concrete jungles, and instead of everyone living in a horizontal way, we start living all vertically. That's much more intelligent. You know, we all live on top of each other instead of spread out. Much more intelligent, right? So now we build these concrete jungles. Everyone comes into the concrete, right, and starts going, living up there, and you have to pump the water up and get... And instead of, you know, growing your food around you, which you can't because there's no land, then you have to go out... then they have to produce the food outwards, and then they have to bring it into the cities, and they have to preserve it for months and months and months. So then it becomes processed. It becomes packaged. It becomes filled with additives and preservatives and all these chemicals, right, to preserve the food. So an interesting fact is that 50% of the processed food which is produced in Europe is thrown in the dump master. Right? This is our world. This is the intelligent world that we're living in these days. Right? So a few years ago we had the G8 summit, right? And the previous Prime Minister of Britain, Tony Blair, he said to everyone, we have to do something about Africa. Right? People are starving all through Africa. Everyone in Europe is eating. We have to do something about Africa. Right? So it's total mismanagement at this point in time. One third of the world's population goes to bed every night hungry. Why? Because simple mismanagement of the governments. Right? They can't distribute the food properly. They can't develop proper agro systems. And then what happens is we get all this processed food. And what happens with the processed food? They just put it on the shelves in Europe and America and Australia and all these places. And then when people don't buy it after it's used by a day, right, then we throw it in the dump masters, 50%. So it's just useless. This is our useless society. So Prabhupada was very heavy on his criticism of these things. Like he says, and this is the famous purport, he says, we're forming a society is forming a dungeon of demons. These are heavy statements. We can understand why the general public doesn't like Prabhupada's books. Right? Dungeons of demons. Right? This is the way Prabhupada... But actually, if you analyse it, just if you look at it objectively, actually it's true, these things. Just like on the weekend, we had Korma Prabhu's retreat. So we were preaching, taking the guests around on an eco tour of the farm, showing them our eco-building, the way we're living, at least in one of the houses on the farm. Hopefully in the future we'll develop more of this type of living. And to our agriculture, which is not much growing at the moment because it's winter. So I apologise to them. It's the worst time of the year to actually have a look at the crop because there's not a lot growing at the moment because it's winter. But at least in February and March, we don't have to buy any vegetables whatsoever on the farm. Everything is, you know, we can grow 15, 20 varieties simultaneously. So we were showing them around and I was preaching to them that actually humans are meant to live simply. Simple living, high thinking. But some of them were arguing with me, debating. No, actually, it's better that we live the way we're living at the moment, in cities with all this type of false jobs that everyone have, all these types of false activities that everyone... Actually, that is better. That is more progressed. So people are attached to this. People are attached to the mode of passion. They're attached to the mode of ignorance. So it's very difficult to actually convince people, no, it's actually better just to live more simply. And you see, Krishna, even when he was living in Dwarka, he was living simply. Right? Dwarka was a very pleasant place to live. It wasn't a city like Melbourne. Melbourne's the most livable city in the world. Right? It has been in the past, in the recent past. The most livable city in the world. But even Melbourne's not that great. You know, compared to Dwarka. Dwarka was a beautiful city. Right? And there were parks everywhere, there were fruit trees growing everywhere, there were orchards everywhere, food was being grown within the boundary of the city. So it was a natural haven. It was a Gora haven, or a Sharma haven. It was a very beautiful place. And people felt inspired. And this is how humans should live. And when humans stop living like this, what happens? As Prabhupada points out, they develop negative qualities. Chanakya says that poverty is the source of all bad qualities. When people are living in poverty, you see they become demoniac tendencies arise, and they become very self-centered and animalistic in their mentality, and they start treating each other in a very poor way. So it's the government's duty to make sure there is no poverty. Prabhupada would criticize the governments, right? There should be no poverty in the world. There should be. Look at India as an example. India is the richest poor country on earth. There's tons of wealth in India. You see the division in the classes in India. It's ridiculous, right? That's mismanagement of the government. Why should it be like that? Why should there be any hungry people? That's when Prabhupada made that famous statement when he was in Kolkata, and he looked across the road from the temple, and children in Calcutta were fighting the dogs in the garbage for food. Straight across from the temple on Albert Road in Calcutta. Prabhupada said no. Prabhupada, tears came to his eyes. He said, no person should go hungry within 10 miles of our temple. It's mismanagement. ISKCON has to do what the government is not doing. Just like they have that program now in all over India. ISKCON, what's it called? The Anamrita? Akshay Patra. They have this program now where they're feeding in the schools, I think the figure is 800,000 kids every day in the schools around India, providing nutritious vegetarian prasadam meals to 800,000 children all over India every day. So this is actually part of our job. We have to do it if the government won't do it. And when the government become inspired because we're actually doing what they're supposed to be doing, then they start giving us money for it. Oh, you're doing such a good job. We couldn't organise it, but we'll give you money so you can expand this. So, Prabhupada would criticise the governments. There should be no poverty on the earth. It's just simple mismanagement. And if everyone follows the principle of Krishna consciousness, if they worship Krishna, there will be no poverty on the earth. Prabhupada said this is the peace formula, which is mentioned within the Bhagavad Gita. What is the first line? Bhaktaram, Jagyatapasam, Suridam, Sava Bhutanam, Sava Loka Maheshwaram. That Krishna is the Sava Loka Maheshwaram. All the living entities on the earth will be protected by Krishna. If you worship Krishna, he will protect everyone on the earth. Everyone will be fed. There's enough to feed all of us. Just like the people on the weekend, they were arguing with me, we have too many people on the earth. 7 billion people. 7 billion. How can we feed everyone? The big problems are coming. Right? But we were explaining to them, if you just change right, the earth from a meat-centered diet, right, to a vegetarian diet, right, a prasadam diet ultimately, right, then you can feed six times more the population of the earth that it currently is, right, which means around about 40 million people. We can house 40 million people on this planet and feed everyone opulently. Everyone can have opulent prasad every day. Raj bhog every day for everyone. Everyone can eat to their full satisfaction. But it has to be managed properly. So Prabhupada would continuously criticize, why is this happening? Why is there this mismanagement? Why is the earth... And it's getting worse and worse and worse. Every time you look at the news, right, what's happening? Spain is falling apart economically. Ireland is falling apart economically. Greece is falling apart economically. And then they say there's 20% unemployment in Greece. What was Prabhupada's answer? Send them out to the fields, right, and grow your own food. That's what the Greeks are famous for, growing their own food. They grew food for centuries. They grow good food. Some of the best food in the world comes from the Mediterranean. Right? So what do? Right? We're unemployed, so we sit around on the streets and we have riots and we, you know, cause problems. Or we could just go out of the city, out of Athens, just go out into the fields and just start producing food like we used to for centuries. Right? And everyone, that solves the problem automatically. But people think that's a backward step. This is how society has become at this point in time. So, as we said, that Dwarka is perfect, Mathura is more perfect, and Vrindavan is the most perfect. Krishna's city of Dwarka, how many palaces were there in the city? Yeah, that was just for his wives, right? And then everyone else in the family, Ugrasen, Vasudeva, everyone else, Balaram, everyone had their own palace as well. So more than 16,000 palaces in the city. And each palace was 4 square miles in diameter. 2 miles wide, 2 miles long. Each palace was that big, right? So how far is that? That's like over 3 kilometers. So that's like from here to past Emsak, right? It's like from, you know, past Emsak, that was just Krishna's palace. Right? Everyone's palace was that big, 2 square miles. Right? 16,000 of them. Right? Plus, calculate that. Right? And how big was Dwarka? Dwarka was 96 square miles in diameter. Mm-hmm. So how does he do that? Right? It's called Achincha Shakti. Inconceivable potency. Right? How can he fit everything like that? So then people say, how is that possible? He can do that. So what would Prabhupada reply? Well, he fits a banyan tree in a seed. Right? A little seed, a banyan tree. Prabhupada says that in Kolkata, in the botanical gardens, there's a banyan tree that covers 1 square mile in diameter. Right? And that came from a little seed. So if he can do that, then why can't he fit 16,000 palaces within a 96-mile area, right? And everyone had their own palace and everything was completely opulent. Now Dwarka is a very interesting place because in Dwarka Krishna feels separation from Vrindavan, like that. So actually Jagannath, Balaram and Subhadra are said to be Krishna when Krishna is in Kurukshetra or Dwarka. There is that pastime which is told in the Puranas that all of the devotees from Vrindavan and all the devotees from Dwarka, they travel to Kurukshetra during the solar eclipse. This is described in the Bhagavatam in the 10th canto. When there was a solar eclipse, everyone met in Dwarka. In Kurukshetra. And they had not seen each other for a long time. So then, Rohini, she was describing to the Dwarkabasis, the residents of Dwarka, about the love of the residents of Vrindavan for Krishna, because they had met, many of them had met the Brijbasis for the first time. And they could see that their love for Krishna was far more intense than the love that they had for Krishna. Even though they were Krishna's family members, the residents of Dwarka, they found that the residents of Vrindavan, they had much more attachment to Krishna. So they want to know, tell us about these Brijbasis. Tell us what it was like when Krishna was living in Vrindavan up until when he was 10. Tell us about his pastimes. So then Rohini, she took all the Dwarkabasis into a pandal And she said to Subhadra, Krishna's sister, she said, stay at the door and don't let Krishna and Balaram come in. Because if they hear how much the residents of Vrindavan are feeling separation from them, it will be intolerable for them. So Subhadra was sitting there, she was guarding the door, and she was listening to Rohini speak to all the Dwarkavasis. But then when she heard about the separation of the Brijbasis from Krishna and Balaram, she became overwhelmed. She became stunned in ecstasy. And when you hear about someone speaking about you in the next room, what do you do? Right? Someone speaking about you in the next room, you go like that. So then Subhadra, she was stunned in ecstasy, and her limbs shrunk into her body, and then she looked like this, like Subhadra Devi. So Balaram came along and he saw Subhadra looks very peculiar. She doesn't normally look like this. So then he was there, and then he began to listen to what Rohini was saying, and then he also manifested this form. And then Krishna came, and he had not seen Balaram and Subhadra like that. So then when he began to listen to Rohini, then also he turned into Jagannath, Balaram and Subhadra. And then Narada, he came at that time and he saw the three of them looking in this particular form. So later on in in Jagannath Puri, there was a great king whose name was Indrajumna. And Maharaj Indrajumna, he had forms of Jagannath or Krishna, Balaram, Subhadra carved by Vishwakarma. And Vishwakarma said, I will carve these forms for you, but the one condition is that you do not interrupt me until I am finished. So he was carving, and then after many days, then King Indrajumna was listening at the door, and for a few days there was no noise. So he thought something's happening. So he opened the door, he walked in. Vishwakarma was still there with the deities, but he had stopped carving for a few days. He was doing some finer work. So then he said to Maharaj Indrajumna, you have interrupted me, you have broken the condition, I will leave now. So Vishwakarma went back to the heavenly planets. And then Maharaj Indrajumna was very distraught because he saw that the deities were in an unfinished condition. So then at that time Narada, he came, and Narada said to Indrajumna, he said, no, I've seen these forms before. And then he told the pastime of what happened at Kurukshetra. And he said, this is Jagannath, Balaram and Subhadra. This is Krishna and Balaram feeling separation from Vrindavan. So it's a very special form of Krishna. So you see in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita that Krishna, he feels great separation from Vrindavan. And in order to relieve his separation from Vrindavan, they call Vishwakarma to come once again, and he constructs another Vrindavan. That's where Prabhupada got this term. When Prabhupada began his farms in the West, he called them New Vrindavan, New Talavan. Right? And then he would call them these names. This is based on Brihad Bhagavatamrita. Another Vrindavan means that they created a new Vrindavan for Krishna. So then Krishna he came out, they carried him out because he was unconscious, feeling separation from Vrindavan. And then he woke up, and then Balaram woke him up, and then he looked around and he saw, I'm in Vrindavan. Suddenly everything looks like Vrindavan. There was another Vrindavan there. So the only difference was that the residents of Vrindavan, like Mother Yashoda, like Radharani, like Nanda Maharaj, they were statues created by Vishwakarma. So they weren't moving. So Krishna ran over to his mother because Balaram said, okay, we have to go out now with the cows. We have to go and tend the cows out in the fields. So he ran over to his mother, and his mother had some yogurt in her hand. So he looked at his mother and he said, Mother, I have to go now. And she was just standing there, like a statue. So he thought, well, sometimes she gets stunned. In Vrindavan, people get stunned. Because sometimes they see Krishna, they just become stunned. So then he thought, well, she's stunned. So he just took the yogurt out of her hand, and then he just ran into the forest with Balaram. But then after some time, he saw a statue of Radharani, and he ran over to Radharani, and he looked around, no one was there, and he kissed her on the cheek. And then he looked around, no one was there, and he looked at Radharani and thought, oh, she is stunned as well. Sometimes she gets stunned when she sees me. So everyone in Vrindavan was stunned. So Krishna thought, okay, well, everyone's stunned today. Obviously my beauty is overwhelming everyone today. Everyone's stunned. So then he kept going until he was looking for the river Jamuna. And then he went down and he found, instead of the river Jamuna, he found the ocean in Dwarka, which is a little different to the Jamuna. So when he saw the ocean, and then he thought, right, and he said to Balaram, he said, what's this? There's an ocean here? There's supposed to be a river. Where's Jamuna? And then he looked around and he started noticing there were slight differences. And he said, where am I? What is this place? And Krishna himself was confused by the influence of Yoga Maya. He said, where am I? What is this place? And then he realized he wasn't actually in Vrindavan. And Balaram explained to him that we're trying to bring you out of your pain of separation. We're trying to bring you into Vrindavan for some time. So actually, Dwarka is perfect, but Mathura is more perfect, and Vrindavan is most perfect. And actually, Krishna prefers to live in Vrindavan, which is interesting. Krishna prefers to live in the country as opposed to the city. And you'll see even in the Mahabharata, Maharaj Pandu, if you read the Mahabharata, he conquered the whole of India to become the emperor, to make the Kuru dynasties the ruling dynasty within India. And then he travelled back to Hastinapur, and when he arrived back at Hastinapur, all the citizens of the city, they came out to greet him, and they offered Maharaj Pandu respect, and he was made the emperor, and he stayed there for a while. But then after some time, he installed the brahmanas to run the government, and then he himself went to the forest. So even though he was the emperor of the earth, he preferred to just reside in the forest. So actually the forest is better. Prabhupada explains, it's natural. And I was listening a few days ago. Prabhupada was in, I think it was Mumbai. And there was one Ayurvedic Kaviraj. And Prabhupada had just opened that farm in Hyderabad. So because Prabhupada's health was not good, he went to see this Kaviraj. And the Kaviraj was giving him some medicine. And that was in Mumbai. Right, and he was living in a very small room, and you know, Mumbai is not very pleasant, especially if you don't have money. It's not pleasant, and even if you have money, it's not pleasant. You know, it's hellish actually. So Prabhupada said to the Kaviraj, he said, why don't you go and open an Ayurveda clinic on my farm in Hyderabad? He said, why don't you go down there? We have a nice farm, we can have a nice clinic like that. You can live in the country, and then you can treat the people there in the country and live naturally, as Ayurveda is supposed to be practiced, and it's supposed to be, you're supposed to treat people in that kind of environment. And then he said, no, I want to stay here in Mumbai. So then when Prabhupada left, he said to Hari Sori Prabhu, he said, just see. He said, they're all attached to the city. Even you give them you offer them to go and live in nature, but they're attached to living in the city. This is the problem with the people in Kali Yuga. So actually, humans are meant to live in a natural environment. In a country environment. But because they're attached to living in the city, then Bhakti Santa Saraswati Thakur said we have to establish the temples in the city. So we establish these temples in the city to preach to them, to convince them to go and live back in the country. And practice Krishna consciousness and live a normal life, actually. I was explaining to the guests the other day at the retreat, I said, we don't need Melbourne. We don't need the city. We don't need it. We can just do away with the whole thing, and everyone can move back out into the country, and we can live there. And they say, no, this is good. You know, we need to have, you know, we have many important things to do in the city. What's so important? Just like now, everyone's on the Westgate Bridge on a traffic jam, right? Going into the city, into the concrete jungle. So you go in there and you work very hard all day, as Prahlada Nandaswami points out, just to maintain those concrete buildings. They work very hard all day just to pay for the window cleaner, who can then go 60 stories up the building, on the side of the building, cleaning the windows. So you can have a nice view out to the next building. Work very hard to pay for your window cleaner. A very sensible lifestyle, isn't it? But then Prabhupada criticized modern society. He said, you can't eat nuts and bolts. He said, your factories are useless. He said, what will you do when there's no food? You can't eat your nuts and bolts. And I was watching an interesting documentary just the other day about Cuba. Because Cuba, in the early 90s, they lost their oil supply from Russia. So suddenly overnight, there wasn't petrol. They had to ration the whole thing. So what did they do? Everyone went outside and started, where they could find land. They started killing the earth and started growing food. Because they didn't have a choice. Because they didn't have enough petrol to run the tractors in the fields, and these mono kind of farms anymore. So then they had to go out and grow their own food. And they successfully did it. And now Cuba, up until this day, is very much based on sustainable agriculture. In other words, if there's a problem in that country, then they will be able to sustain themselves because they've become greatly independent from fossil fuels and so forth. Actually, Australia is in a very good situation in terms of food production as well. We produce a lot of food here. Right? We're second biggest producers of rice on the planet, just behind China. So we have a ton of food here. The only problem is if we run out of petrol, we won't be able to get it from New South Wales to Victoria. So we've got to work out better systems like that. But it's only when things break down that everyone will be forced to. So things will break down. We don't know when. Maybe 100 years from now, maybe 200 years from now, maybe 5 years from now. We don't know, but things will break down. And then people will have to go back to that natural lifestyle, which is actually mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita. That's the way we're supposed to live. Prabhupada himself, he used to always go every morning out to the parks to have morning walks. Prabhupada went to the botanical gardens many, many times. He actually said the botanical gardens are some of the best gardens in the world. If you've been there, very beautiful gardens. You can walk all around. And it was designed in such a way, back then, now they've built these huge buildings, but because it's all built through hills, it was designed in such a way that you couldn't see buildings anywhere. Because all the buildings are only two or three stories high. But because they put the trees in the right places, you had a feeling when you're in the botanical gardens that you're fully in nature. You're away from everything. But then they built the MCG and the tennis centre and everything, so now you can see it. So it's kind of destroyed the tranquility of the place to a degree. But still, it's very beautiful there. And Prabhupada walked all through those gardens on every path. So it's a holy tirtha. And also down here on Beaconsfield Parade, Prabhupada used to walk along here as well on the other side of the road along the beach. You see pictures. So that's also a holy tirtha. So you can you can roll in the dust of those places. Just make sure cars aren't going by when you do it. So. And make sure you're not wearing your dhoti so people don't see the Hare Krishnas are rolling around and begging to go for it. Have to be conscientious of our preaching. So we'll stop there. I want to see if there's any questions or comments on what we discussed. Yeah, we've progressed so nicely now. We can go anywhere very quickly now. Such progression. We're so progressed. Just like in the old days, if you wanted to walk from Paris to Delhi, it would take 6 months to walk from Paris to Delhi. But these days, we've become much more progressed. Right? You can work for 6 months to pay for a ticket to fly from Paris to Delhi. Right. Much more progressed. Or if you go to Sydney, if you go from Parramatta to Sydney, 100 years ago, if you had a horse and a cart, it would take you 1 hour to go from Parramatta to Sydney. From Parramatta to Sydney on the with a horse and cart. These days, it takes more than 1 hour in a traffic jam. So we're progressed. We're so much further ahead now. Hey, can't you see that everything's so much better now? So, any other question or comment?
This reminds me of the
Natural opulence. Yeah, when you hear the sounds of nature, they make the mind peaceful, generally, most of them, except for the crows and things like that. But no, generally, the sounds of nature, they make the mind peaceful, and the sounds which are created by men make the mind disturbed. Yeah, you hear the sounds of it disturbs the consciousness, whereas the sounds of nature, they make the mind peaceful naturally. Everything was okay until the last 100 years when we had an industrial revolution, and then we thought we'd progress so much, but actually we've, in 100 years we've damaged the planet more than we damaged it in the previous 10,000 years. So, any other points?
Just that it's interesting that one of the points is that people living in the city, it's got a dungeon of demons. So they're like they're prisoners, dungeon men instead of prisoners. And as a result of them being entrapped in that environment, it's very difficult to preach to them. It's difficult to have them understand. Even though so obvious they're in a dungeon, still they think, oh, how really did we really, we're making advancement, we're making progress. And when you try to explain to them, no, you know, you're not making progress, they can't understand it because they're so caught up in this environment and it's so soul destroying that they can't understand the stupidity of the situation.
Yeah, and they become pacified by television. Because television dulls the brain, dulls the consciousness, and most people are addicted to television. So it actually brings the brain down to about 10% of its natural activity. There's so much stimulation when you're watching television, you don't actually use your brain, and you don't actually think, and you don't actually... So they just go and lull into a mindless kind of condition. Whereas when you read books, Peter Verwoerd points this out, when you read books, then like 90% or 80% of your imagination is stimulated. So you read this description, then your mind becomes vivid and active. And you see, children who don't watch television, they become far more sharper and far more imaginative and far more brain, I suppose, fertile. Than you see, children watch television these days, they're always playing on the games and everything, and they're just becoming very dull in their consciousness. They don't have the same learning capacity that children had previously. One of the people who came on the retreat with Korma on the weekend, she's actually a school teacher, and she's only a primary school teacher, and she's actually quite stressed. She almost cancelled coming to the retreat because she was stressed. And then they ended up coming, and she was telling me that she is a primary school teacher at Ashburton, which is quite a good suburb, affluently. But she says that there's some of the kids have such serious problems because of what's happening in their personal lives at home, and that's... straining her in the classroom because she's having to deal with that. She's extremely stressed. So we've basically mucked everything up in the last 100 years. And Prabhupada was very emphatic. Actually, it's interesting because I was listening to Hari Sawari Prabhu the other day, that final tour that Prabhupada went on when he went to London and then he came back because he got sick, that tour was just for the farms. He was only going to the farms on that last tour. Because he said, I just want to encourage the farms. He said, I've done everything else. I'm successful in every other way, but the farms still need to be brought up. That was his final mission, you could say, or his final legacy, or his final desire to bring the farms up to a better position. Like that. Because Prabhupada understood that we need to live naturally. In due course of time, people need to go back and live in a natural environment. And the more I see these things, there's some excellent documentaries out there. That's why we have to join with these people who are thinking in this way. Some excellent documentaries about how to live like this. And you can just see the superiority of the lifestyle and the necessity of living like that in the future. And Prabhupada understood that. He emphasized that a lot in his books, living like that, living naturally. And it's a mission. ISKCON has to show that example, because many other people are beginning to show that example around the world. So, any other questions? Comments?
How would you find difference between Bombay and Pune?
Wada. Wada. Yeah, Wada and Mumbai.
And Bremen.
Yeah, quite different. Quite different. Very different. Any other questions or comments?
In fact, Prabhupada Pune is much better than any other cities probably. They are not so advanced. Because what I have seen is, like, I live in Pune as well as in Ahmedabad. Ahmedabad is very advanced, actually, for kinds of people, like, praise about the practice, like, what advanced they have done. But Pune is, like, always people complain about the government, but still, like, Pune has got so much preserve in the CBD, like, you get so many trees and about it, and they haven't allowed any commercials to touch them. They have preserved it all.
Yeah, Prabhu is actually speaking about Wada, not Pune. He meant Wada. It's interesting because the devotees were telling me in Wada, although it's in the rural area, it's famous for being a place where everyone is drunk. All the farmers, they grow their crops, and then during the rainy season and so forth, when they can't work as much, they distill the rice and they turn it into a fermented grog. And then they drink it. So it's famous for being a place where people just drink and sleep. You know. And then when there's opportunity to farm, they go and farm. So this is Kali Yuga. Mode of ignorance is out there. Mode of ignorance is in the city. It's the same thing. So we have to preach and combat it and bring people to the mode of goodness and then to spiritual consciousness. So it's basically it's challenging everywhere. Just like I live down in the country. And the people down there, I mean, they're much more... I'd say laid back than the people up here, but they're still addicted to all the same things. They eat a lot of meat down there, they drink a lot. Very nice people, but they're very contaminated by the lower modes of nature. So our mission is to bring everyone up to a higher level. Just on the like on the weekend we had that vegetarian retreat, and I think that's the sixth one that I've held with Korma Prabhu in the last 3 years. But it was interesting, on this particular retreat, more of them were meat eaters. Generally, we attract a lot of vegetarians because it's a vegetarian cooking retreat, but about 75% of them were actually meat eaters. And we were educating them. We were saying, actually, you don't have to eat meat. It's detrimental for you. It's detrimental for the planet. And it's detrimental for our spiritual progress. And one of the ladies, she wrote an email to us when she got back to Melbourne, straight away. She wrote back and she said, I've been thinking about everything you're saying. I'm definitely going to have to consider being a vegetarian. You know, and we show them how to offer the food. After Korma Prabhu cooks it, we make a plate up, we take it into the altar, and I show them how we do an offering. And she said, I like this whole concept about nourishing the soul, because I was telling them when we offer the food, then the soul also becomes nourished, not just the body. She said, I like this whole concept. I have to consider all these things, and I'll be back. And so this is what we have to do. We have to set an example to the world, right? In the country, in the cities. We just have to teach them basically to follow the peace formula. And to satisfy Krishna and to worship Krishna. That is the answer. Prabhupada was convinced of that. Okay, so we'll stop there. Srila Prabhupada ki.